Vorlach Vorbach Reads. Produced by the Cincinnati and Hamilton County Public Library.
Welcome to Vorlach Vorbach Reads, a Cincinnati and Hamilton County Public Library podcast. Last time I read from the very first Gothic novel, and now I will read from the most famous Gothic novelist of her time. Oh yes, I am speaking of Anne Radcliffe and her famous novel, The Mysteries of Udolpho. Anne was an only child and described as shy. She married a journalist at age 23 and published her first novel at age 25, quickly becoming the most popular and well-paid writer of her time. The money she earned allowed her husband to quit his job and for the two of them to travel throughout Europe. Towards the end of her life, Anne retreated from the public eye, which led to false speculation that her writing caused her insanity. In 1794, she published in four volumes The Mysteries of Udolpho, her most famous novel. This quintessential novel is about an orphaned farm girl, Emily, whose aunt wants to marry her off to a man she does not love. A series of misadventures sends her to the gloomy and haunted castle of Udolpho, where a series of supernatural terrors happen. Jane Austen would later satirize this novel in Northanger Abbey. And now I will read a few of these spooky moments from The Mysteries of Udolpho by Anne Radcliffe. As they passed up, the wind, which poured through the narrow cavities in the wall, made the torch flare, and it threw a stronger gleam upon the grim and sallow countenance of Barnardine, and discovered more fully the desolation of the place. The rough stone walls, the spiral stairs black with age, and a suit of ancient armor with an iron visor that hung upon the walls and appeared a trophy of some former victory. Having reached a landing place, "You may wait here, lady," said he, applying a key to the door of a chamber, "while I go up and tell the signora you are coming." "The ceremony is unnecessary," replied Emily. "My aunt will rejoice to see me." "I am not sure of that," said Barnardine, pointing to the room he had opened. "Come in here, lady, while I step up." Emily, surprised and somewhat shocked, did not dare to oppose him further. But, as he was turning away with the torch, desired he would not leave her in darkness. He looked around, and, observing a tripod lamp that stood on the stairs, lighted and gave it to Emily, who stepped forward into a large old chamber, and he closed the door. As she listened anxiously to his departing steps, she thought he descended instead of ascended the stairs. But the gusts of wind that whistled round the portal would not allow her to hear distinctly any other sound. Still, however, she listened, and perceiving no step in the room above, where he had affirmed Madame Montani to be, her anxiety increased, though she considered that the thickness of the floor in this strong building might prevent any sound reaching her from the upper chamber. The next moment, in a pause of the wind, she distinguished Barnardine's step descending to the court, and then thought she heard his voice. But the rising gust again of overcoming other sounds, Emily, to be certain on this point, moved softly to the door, which, on attempting to open it, she discovered was fastened. All the horrid apprehensions that had lately assailed her returned at this instant with redoubled force, and no longer appeared like the exaggerations of a timid spirit, but seemed to have been sent to warn her of her fate. She now did not doubt that Madame Montani had been murdered, perhaps in this very chamber, or that she herself was brought hither for the same purpose. The countenance, the manners, and the recollected words of Barnardine when he had spoken of her aunt confirmed her worst fears. For some moments, she was incapable of considering of any means by which she might attempt an escape. Still, she listened, but heard footsteps neither on the stairs nor in the room above. She thought, however, that she again distinguished Barnardine's voice below and went to a grated window that opened upon the court to inquire further. Here, she plainly heard his hoarse accents mingling with the blast that swept by, but they were lost again so quickly that their meaning could not be interpreted. And then the light of a torch, which seemed to issue from the portal below, flashed across the court, and the long shadow of a man, who was under the archway, appeared upon the pavement. Emily, from the hugeness of the sudden portrait, concluded it to be that of Barnardine, but other deep tones which passed in the wind soon convinced her he was not alone, and that his companion was not a person very liable to pity. When her spirits had overcome the first shock of her situation, she held up the lamp to examine if the chamber afforded a possibility of escape. It was a spacious room, whose walls, wainscoted with rough oak, showed no casement but the grated one which Emily had left, and no other door than that by which she had entered. The feeble rays of the lamp, however, did not allow her to see at once its full extent. She perceived no furniture, except, indeed, an iron chair fastened in the center of the chamber, immediately over which, dependent on a chain from the ceiling, hung an iron ring. Having gazed upon these for some time with wonder and horror, she next observed iron bars below, made for the purpose of confining the feet, and on the arms of the chair were rings of the same metal. As she continued to survey them, she concluded that they were instruments of torture, and it struck her that some poor wretch had once been fastened in this chair and had been starved to death. She was chilled by the thought, but what was her agony when, in the next moment, it occurred to her that her aunt might have been one of these victims, and that she herself might be the next. An acute pain seized her head, and she was scarcely able to hold the lamp, and looking round for support, was seating herself unconsciously in the iron chair itself. But suddenly perceiving where she was, she started from it in horror, and sprung towards a remote end of the room. Here again she looked round for a seat to sustain her, and perceived only a dark curtain, which, descending from the ceiling to the floor, was drawn along the whole side of the chamber. Ill as she was, the appearance of this chamber struck her, and she paused to gaze upon it in wonder and apprehension. It seemed to conceal a recess of the chamber. She wished, yet dreaded, to lift it, and to discover what it veiled. Twice she was withheld by a recollection of the terrible spectacle her daring hand had formerly unveiled in an apartment of the castle, till, suddenly conjecturing that it concealed the body of her murdered aunt, she seized it in a fit of desperation and drew it aside. Beyond appeared a corpse stretched on a kind of low couch, which was crimsoned with human blood, as was the floor beneath. The features, deformed by death, were ghastly and horrible, and more than one livid wound appeared in the face. Emily, bending over the body, gazed for a moment with an eager, frenzied eye. But in the next, the lamp dropped from her hand, and she fell senseless at the foot of the couch. Ooh. Well, I'm going to skip a little bit ahead now into the story. And we're going to get a little scene where Dorothy is taking Emily into this room in which her lady had previously lived and perished in. And they're going to have a little spooky encounter. "This is a sad, forlorn place," said Dorothy, "for when my dear lady died, I had no heart to put it to rights, or the chamber either, and my lord never came into the rooms after, so they remain just as they did when my lady was removed for internment." While Dorothy spoke, Emily was still looking on the lute, which was a Spanish one, and remarkably large. And then, with a hesitating hand, she took it up and passed her fingers over the chords. They were out of tune, but uttered a deep and full sound. Dorothy started at their well-known tones, and seeing the lute in Emily's hand, said, "This is the lute my lady Marchioness loved so. I remember when last she played upon it. It was on the night that she died. I came as usual to undress her, and as I entered the bedchamber, I heard the sound of music from the oriel, and perceiving it was my lady's, who was sitting there, I stepped softly to the door, which stood a little open, to listen, for the music, though it was mournful, was so sweet. There I saw her, with the lute in her hand, looking upwards, and the tears fell upon her cheeks while she sung a vesper hymn, so soft and so solemn, and her voice trembled as it were. And then she would stop for a moment and wipe away her tears and go on again lower than before. Oh, I had often listened to my lady, but never heard anything so sweet as this. It made me cry almost to hear it. She had been at prayers, I fancy, for there was the book open on the table beside her. Aye, and there it lies, open still. Pray, let us leave the oriel, mademoiselle," added Dorothy. "This is a heartbreaking place." Having returned into the chamber, she desired to look once more upon the bed, when as they came opposite to the open door leading to the saloon, Emily, in the partial gleam which the lamp threw into it, thought she saw something glide along into the obscure part of the room. Her spirits had been much affected by the surrounding scene, or it is probable the circumstance, whether real or imaginary, would not have affected her in the degree it did. But she endeavored to conceal her emotion from Dorothy, who, however, observing her countenance change, inquired if she was ill. "Let us go," said Emily faintly. "The air of these rooms is unwholesome." But when she attempted to do so, considering that she must pass through the apartment where the phantom of her terror had appeared, this terror increased, and too faint to support herself, she sat down on the side of the bed. Dorothy, believing that she was only affected by a consideration of the melancholy catastrophe which had happened on this spot, endeavored to cheer her. And then, as they sat together on the bed, she began to relate other particulars concerning it. And this without reflecting that it might increase Emily's emotion, but because they were particularly interesting to herself. "A little before my lady's death," said she, "when the pains were gone off, she called me to her, and stretching out her hand to me, I sat down just there, where the curtain falls upon the bed. How well I remember her look at the time. Death was in it. I can almost fancy I see her now. There she lay, mademoiselle. Her face was upon the pillow there. This black counterpane was not upon the bed then. It was lain on after her death, and she was laid out upon it." Emily turned to look within the dusky curtains, as if she could have seen the countenance of which Dorothy spoke. The edge of the white pillow only appeared above the blackness of the pall. But as her eyes wandered over the pall itself, she fancied she saw it move. Without speaking, she caught Dorothy's arm, who, surprised by the action and by the look of terror which accompanied it, turned her eyes from Emily to the bed, where, in the next moment, she too saw the paw slowly lifted and fall again. Emily attempted to go, but Dorothy stood fixed and gazed upon the bed, and at length said, "It is only the wind that waves it, Mademoiselle. We have left all the doors open. See how the air waves the lamp, too? It is only the wind." She had scarcely uttered these words when the paw was more violently agitated than before. But Emily, somewhat ashamed of her terrors, stepped back to the bed, willing to be convinced that the wind only had occasioned her alarm. When, as she gazed within the curtains, the paw moved again, and in the next moment the apparition of a human countenance rose above it. Screaming with terror, they both fled and got out of the chamber as fast as their trembling limbs would bear them, leaving open the doors of all the rooms through which they passed. When they reached the staircase, Dorothy threw open a chamber door where some of the female servants slept and sank breathless on the bed, while Emily, deprived of all presence of mind, made only a feeble attempt to conceal the occasion of her terror from the astonished servants. And though Dorothy, when she could speak, endeavored to laugh at her own fright, and was joined by Emily, no remonstrances could avail with the servants, who had quickly taken the alarm, to pass even the remainder of the night in a room near to these terrific chambers. Thank you so much for listening to Warlock Vorabach Reads, a Cincinnati and Hamilton County Public Library podcast. I have to say, I love that last bit there where Emily and Dorothy just run away from the ghost as fast as possible. You don't usually see smart thinking in horror books or movies. By the way, you want to get into some Italian horror? I got some great suggestions for you. First, you gotta check out all those 70s giallo movies like Dario Argento's Deep Red or Suspiria. And if you want to read a book, check out the newly translated 20 Days of Turin by Giorgio de Maria, a vision of mass fear that resonates even more today in our social media days. So go to our website or the app and place those recommendations on hold. Next time, we will delve into the very spark of life with one of my favorite novels of all time. Till next time.
Thanks for listening to Warlock Vorabach Reads. Subscribe to this podcast right now so you don't miss future episodes. And discover more of our podcasts at chpl.org/podcasts.